Today at Reader's Corner, longtime Idaho Statesman columnist Tim Woodward, author of Destination Idaho.
When I first started at the Statesman, we had a bigger staff. They sent me to Europe and all around the country on trains to do stories. Those days are long gone. But I think there will always be a need for what journalists do, particularly the watchdog role. I think that's critical that that never fades away. The column was about how I saw Idaho, its physical beauty, and the variety and uniqueness of its people. To me, it's kind of half column and half poem.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Today's guest needs no introduction for many of our listeners. Tim Woodward has been a fixture at the Idaho Statesman for 40 years, sharing his unique take on the state, its people, and its places in columns, profiles, and stories. His latest book, Destination Idaho, is a collection of writings that first appeared in the Statesman and focus on his life in Idaho as a husband, father, and roving reporter. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Tim. He was born in Boise and educated in Boise schools, including 2 years at Boise Junior College. Tim graduated from the University of Idaho with a journalism degree in 1971, married a week later, and went to work that fall at the Idaho Statesman. He has worked as a government reporter, investigative reporter, editorial writer, and a spate of other jobs at the Statesman, but he is best known for his work as a regular columnist that began in 1975. Tim wrote 3 columns a week for 18 years and has published 6 books, 4 of which are column collections. He retired from the Statesman in June 2011. Tim joined me in the studio for this interview. Tim Woodward, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Let's begin by talking about your background in journalism. When you took off for the University of Idaho to get your journalism degree, did you know you wanted to come right back to Boise, Idaho and join the Statesman? Was that the plan and it just worked perfectly for you, or did you know where you were going?
I did not have a plan, actually. At the time, I struggled the whole time I was growing up with my father. I wanted to be a writer. He wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer. And when I went to the University of Idaho, I still didn't know what I wanted to do. My first semester, I majored in advertising. I took courses in architecture. And it wasn't until the summer before my senior year that I called my advisor and said, can I switch to journalism? I decided that that was what I'd be good at, and if I was good enough at it, things would work out okay. He gasped. There was a long silence. He said, Tim, nobody switches majors when they're seniors. But he worked it out so that I could, and when I got out, there were no jobs available. I ended up taking pictures for National Schools photographers for several months, traveling around the state, taking pictures of school kids and their teachers. And when I realized that by the time I paid my expenses 1 week and deducted the expenses of my salary, I had $10 left over, I quit the job on a Friday, and Saturday the Statesman called and offered me a job. I've been there ever since.
How fortuitous.
It was.
Wow, that's a neat story. Well, it's been 2004 since you and I have talked, and lots has changed in this world we live in, certainly in the profession you come from. Since the economic decline, we've seen newspapers shrink.
Absolutely.
And I just wondered what your take is on all of the changes that have occurred around us, especially when it comes to news gathering, news reporting, news analysis, commentary, the kind of column writing that you did over the years, which really brings to life the culture people are surrounded with in their daily lives. What do you think of all this?
Well, we're obviously not seeing as much of that. As you said, the papers have shrunk. Budgets are much smaller. Staffs are smaller. When I go to the Statesman now and walk in the newsroom, I'm shocked at how few people there are. So there's not as much of it. When I first started at the Statesman, papers almost had a license to print money. We had a bigger staff. They sent me to Europe to do stories and all around the country on trains to do stories. Those days are long gone, but I think there will always be a need for what journalists do, particularly the watchdog role. I think that's critical that that never fades away. And I have to think that there will be a new newspaper, something maybe we can't even imagine right now, that will fill that need. Mm-hmm. I know the New York Times is working very hard on it, and It's got to be done, and right now we're in a low point, but I have to think it's going to come back.
What about the online newspaper? That certainly has struggled, mainly because newspapers were giving it away for a long time, and now they're trying to recoup some of their cost by charging for it, which they probably should have done a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But do you think that will work?
I hope so. And it's starting to work. They're starting to get some revenue from online. But whether it's going to be the big success we would hope it would be, I don't know. You know, a number of years ago, we couldn't have imagined the internet. And I just have to think that there's something out there that's going to be invented that will put papers back in the black.
You know, we talk about the world changing around us, and it reminds me that it's not just the journalism profession or the newspaper business that's changed, but the very city you grew up in and the state you covered. But especially Boise has changed. And when I read your book, Destination Idaho, I do wonder, wow, where's the next Tim Woodward who needs to report on the new Boise? Because these folks that I'm talking about all seem to be fairly invisible to those of us who go to the mall, who go out to eat. You don't see a lot of Somalis. You don't see a lot of Bosnians. You don't see folks from Myanmar who are here as political refugees, and yet they're living right amongst us in small enclaves, sticking to themselves, and in some way or another making up the fabric of this community, and yet, for the most part, it seems they go unreported, don't they?
To a degree, yes. I'm sure there is someone on the Statesman staff and television news staffs that is responsible for that, but they're probably also responsible for half a dozen other things. So they do what they can, but it's not the kind of coverage we'd all like to see. For a couple of years, I was covering refugees. That was part of my beat.
Oh, yeah.
And I spent a lot of time with them, did special sections, and we devoted hundreds of hours covering the refugee community. But that seemed to go by the wayside when the economy changed. There just isn't a budget for it anymore. Maybe there's somebody else out there. Maybe somebody working for National School Studios now will be the next person to cover that. Who knows?
So what kind of an adjustment was it for you when you went to the news gathering and the news reporting end of the business to the column end of the business? Because when you get into the column business, all of a sudden your identity matters. Tim Woodward is important. When you're writing the story on a fire the night before, anybody could be writing that story. But you had to deal with the personality issue over the years. Are you still spotted around town when people stop you every now and then and talk about columns?
Absolutely. Happened twice yesterday. When I first started, I was a bureau reporter over in the Canyon County Bureau, and then I came over and covered city government in Boise. And my editors did everything but beat me over the head to keep my opinions out of my news stories. They said, don't editorialize. And they finally broke me of it to the point that I was an objective, fair reporter of hard news. And then they said, how would you like to try a call? So suddenly I had license to be myself and express my opinions, and I loved it. It just took off from there. It was a natural fit for me.
Did you have to be careful how far you wanted to go or might go in a column? I mean, did you sometimes have your editor call you back and say, Tim, do you really want to say that? Now they're gonna jump all over us here, and we're going to get all kinds of letters. I mean, how often did something like that happen?
Occasionally, but not often.
Yeah.
I was always a pretty careful guy.
Yeah.
And exercised discretion. And yeah, there were columns that would keep you up nights, wondering if you had said the right thing or gone too far. And sometimes I did and paid the price. There was one column that I had people calling me at home at 2 o'clock in the morning and hanging up. 10 years later, I was at a New Year's party. And when a man at the party found out who I was, he wanted to go outside and fight. So
from an article you had
written
10 years before,
10 years earlier.
This is the guy who carries a grudge.
yes, he does. So I would have taken that one back, but it didn't happen often.
Well, if there's one thing about your book, Destination Idaho, that I enjoyed, it's probably two things, because we already talked before the show. I was telling you I'm so fascinated with the really interesting places you got to visit in order to do this book and to do your columns, actually. But the other is the people. But before we get to the people, the very last column in the book is one you wrote, I think it was in 1980, so that's 32 years ago, but it was an article you wrote about Idaho.
Right.
And it was like, I think you were asking yourself the question, or somebody was asking you the question, What's so different about Idaho? And I'm not asking you to read the column, but if you could, in a few words anyway, summarize what the state does mean to you and why it is, as far as you're concerned, a pretty unique place to live.
I wrote that column after Mount St. Helens erupted. And at the time, I was feeling a bit restless myself. I had been offered a job at the Seattle Times, a General Simon reporter, and decided not to go, that I was going to stay in Idaho. One thing, I was born here, and the other thing was that, you know, Idaho is such a diverse and beautiful state. Everything from deserts to alpine lakes to rugged mountains, and the endless supply of unique Idaho characters that I love to write about. There were probably dugout dicks and other characters in other states, but I just seemed to find an endless supply of them here in Idaho. And I loved writing those kinds of stories. And so the column, that column was about, part of it was how I saw Idaho, its physical beauty and the variety and uniqueness of its people. And it's, to me, it's kind of half column and half poem, almost. It was, of all the things I've written, it's the most reprinted and probably my favorite. That's why we made it the last one in the book.
Well, if we could talk for a moment about some of those interesting characters. One right here in Boise, Pinto Bennett.
Yes.
I've heard stories that Pinto Bennett might well have been one of Nashville's most successful recording artists. Things got in the way, or it didn't work out the way it should have. Maybe you can comment on how that all comes to pass. But until recently, and maybe you can bring us up to date, he could be found at the 44 Club or various places around town playing on Saturday afternoons.
Right. I think Pinto is one of the most gifted songwriters in the country. His lyrics are absolutely marvelous. And he didn't make it in Nashville. His wife's explanation was that he was too honest. He didn't pull any punches in his lyrics. And he didn't tell the sweet tales that you hear often in country music. They were pretty close to the bone, a lot of them. In that sense, he was a little bit like Bob Dylan. And Nashville wasn't quite ready for that. A lot of people thought that if he'd gone to Austin, Texas instead, he might be a household word now. But instead, he made it in England. He was a big name in England, traveled in Europe a lot, came back here and slipped into a life of relative obscurity, but he has no regrets. He says he'd do everything the same again. He'll probably be famous after he's dead, and he's okay with that.
Now, does he still perform?
He does, but not often. He 2 years ago, he built his sheep wagon, because he grew up on a sheep ranch and tended sheep as a child. And it's a trailer that he built and hauls with a couple of mules, and he took it out into the desert in Owyhee County. And he's been living there alone ever since. Still writes songs, still records, still performs now and then, but he's kind of retired from that life. Mm-hmm. He's enjoying his solitude. He has discovered religion late in his life, become very religious, and claims that he's quit drinking, which no one thought would ever happen. And he claims he's happier than he's ever been. He seems very content. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Fuzzy Stewart in Arco. I mean, that, what an incredible story. It's a story that's complete and amazing all by itself. But then you learn, on top of what he's done in Arco, he was one of the founders of MISTI?
He was.
The Mountain States Tumor Institute.
Right. Harvard Phi Beta Kappa, Johns Hopkins, marvelously educated, brilliant man. He was the guru of the medical community here in Boise, or at least one of them, and decided that when he reached a certain age, he was tired of dealing with insurance companies and government regulations. He moved to Arco. Charged $10 for an office call. Sometimes if you didn't have $10, he'd take a beer or you could play a song for him. He saw patients on his front porch, and they were getting this marvelous medical ability and training for practically nothing. And everyone in the community loved him. He became a fixture there overnight. And sadly, not long after I interviewed him and wrote that story, he choked at dinner and died. Sad way for a medical man of his stature to go.
You're listening to Tim Woodward. He's the author of Destination Idaho and, of course, the longtime columnist for the Idaho Statesman. Well, whatever happened to Garfield Schultz's pecan trees and all of his trees? And are they still out there in Owyhee County somewhere? Tell us about this guy.
They are still there. Garfield Schultz is still over near Homedale, probably growing 14 kinds of fruit on one tree. And loving every minute of it. He was obsessed by fruit, growing fruit trees as a child, and has never stopped. He's invented new varieties of his own. He's known all over the country as Garfield Schultz, the fruit pioneer, and to the best of my knowledge, he's still at it and still out there on a sunny slope in Owyhee County growing his fruit trees.
And it's the pecan tree, though, that he really figured out a way to grow in Idaho, a special variety of it that would survive the weather.
He did. He found one, and it wouldn't surprise me if I went out there now and he was growing banana trees. If anybody could do it, it would be Garfield.
And it is a retail establishment? You go out there to buy things from this guy?
He does sell things. It's not a retail establishment in the sense of Costco or something. It's a very small operation. He's a one-man operation. But he's there most of the time, and he has signs out. And during the season, yes, he likes to sell all his fruit.
Certainly one of the most difficult and sad chapters in Boise history was the Morrison Knutson Company and what happened to it. Mm-hmm. And you wrote a column comparing or contrasting Harry Morrison to Bill Agee. And
Right. Since
I've come to town, I know that if you really want to be called something bad in this town, they'll call you Bill Agee. Your column was, I thought, very fair in that you really didn't focus so much criticizing Bill Agee, because I think you said up front, I really don't know Bill Agee, but you certainly knew, and everyone knew, Harry Morrison.
Right.
And that was quite a story all in itself.
It was. Harry Morrison was universally revered in Boise. He was a man of great principle. Everyone who worked for him seemed to love him. I knew him through his stepson. And to me, meeting Harry Morrison for the first time was like meeting God. He was tall and erect, had a craggy face and a mane of white hair. And I met him because his stepson and I were in a band together, and we used to go to the Morrison's house to practice. And I was terrified to meet the Harry Morrison, but he couldn't have been nicer. He always encouraged us to do our best, play well. We must have sounded absolutely awful to his ears, but he still was kind and encouraging. And just pretty much the opposite of the way people felt about Bill Agee when he left. So that's why I wrote the column, the contrast between the two.
Well, speaking of the icons of Boise industry, you can't really go very far in that discussion without talking about J.R. Simplot.
No, you can't.
And you've spent some time talking about him. In fact, I think that was one of your longer pieces I read in the book. Tell us about Mr. Spud from your perspective.
Mr. Spud was like no one else. He was contagiously enthusiastic. I don't think he ever had a bad day. He was always optimistic. He believed in himself. He was willing to take any business proposition. A friend of mine, an artist, moved here and became the graphic designer for the Statesman, and she was also a sculptor, and she wanted to do an edition of bronzes. She said, "Who's the richest man in town?" Everybody said, "J.R. Simplot." So she said, "Where do I find him?" We told him where to find him. She went up to his house. Said, "Here's the deal. You pay the foundry bill and we'll split the profits." He agreed. And when she took him up to check for the first profits, she said, "You'd have thought it was his first dollar." He was willing to back anyone that he thought was going to be successful. He was, I cannot say that I know him well, but I did interview him a number of times. And he was a man who used profanity as an art form. I don't think even a nun could have been offended. He did it so beautifully. It was just part of his nature. He was colorful. He was enthusiastic. He was like no one else I've ever met.
Well, you know, when I read your book in terms of where I might want to travel across Idaho, there's one general store I have to visit before too long in Peekaboo. Tell us about this general store. I mean, what could I buy in that general store that you wouldn't expect to buy in Peekaboo, Idaho?
Anything. You can buy at the Peekaboo General Store. You can buy anything from laundry to a bucket of nails to farm equipment. I asked the you can have lunch there. You can mail a letter there. There's almost nothing they don't have. As I was leaving after I interviewed the general manager, I said, "Is there anything you don't sell?" And he thought about it for a while and said, "Yes, we don't sell cars." And then there was a pause. And he said, "But we used to."
That's great. And I assume that this place must depend on traffic coming from someplace else.
Yes, to a degree. It's near Silver Creek, the famous trout stream, so they get a lot of recreationalists there buying things. But it's also the farming community, which is spread out over many, many square miles. They patronized the store. And Peekaboo, of course, was the namesake for Peekaboo Street, the skier, who was
right.
from that area.
Right.
I'm sure she brought a lot of ski equipment there.
Of course. Tom Trusky, one of our own at Boise State, lover of books. You wrote a column about Tom,
right.
who just passed away not too long ago.
Right. The impetus for the column was his gift to the university of the James Castle mm-hmm. work and his zines and art books, which was an incredible gift, surpassed anyone's expectations. And Tom was a character in and of himself. He drove the same car for something like 35,000 miles without changing the oil. He lived in a modest home in the North End, and he was known as a brilliant, brilliant man who was utterly dedicated to his work, to books, and preserving what he loved, and he did a wonderful job of it.
You're listening to Tim Woodward. He's the author of Destination Idaho and a longtime columnist for the Idaho Statesman. You talk about your family in this book, and I'm referring mainly to the article that I read about your mom and dad and your Irish mother. Mm-hmm. I have an Irish had an Irish mother, and I got a kick out of the fact that I think you mentioned her sayings. The way she would characterize right. things that you hear them now and people don't understand where they even came from. But, mm-hmm. boy, I could really relate to those in growing mm-hmm. up with this Irish mother who had a saying for everything that ever happened in the course right. of a day. Isn't that right?
Right. She said they used to say that she was as Irish as Paddy's pig.
Yep.
So-and-so didn't amount to a hill of beans. He made me feel like 2 cents waiting for change. And one of my favorites, and that I hope to use maybe someday in the title of a book, is her unfailing name for the Statesman was the Daily Blab.
Harold Hannenbaum, is that his name, the inventor?
Hannenbaum, yes. Oh,
amazing guy. I mean, this is a guy right here, one of Idaho's best in... Boy, did he invent some interesting things.
Yes, he did. He claimed to have invented the rotary lawnmower before anyone else out of spare parts on a farm where he grew up and didn't think anything of it, gave them to his neighbors, and one day he saw one in a store, a Kmart or somewhere, and said, darn, I should have gotten a patent on that. So then he started getting patents, and he invented many, many things. But his most famous and financially successful invention was the carousel glass fireplace. He made a lot of money on that and was set for life and able to do the things he wanted to do. He had a Lincoln, an old, probably 20-year-old Lincoln that he had somehow altered to run on mostly water. And you'd be driving along, there'd be a big cloud of steam coming out the tailpipe, and he had a little gauge that showed the percentage of gas versus water that was being used. And he said, look, we're practically riding on steam entirely now. And why that never took off, I don't know, because Harold had it 30 years ago.
Joe Munch,
the prison guard at the Idaho State Penitentiary, fascinating man. Grew up in Germany, was a member of the Hitler Youth, and left after the war, thought that his father had been killed and didn't know where his mother was. Became a member of the French Foreign Legion because it was the only military organization in the world that would accept Germans after World War II. Became an officer in the French Foreign Legion, was part of the OSS that opposed de Gaulle, lived some horrific stories, things that no one should ever have to do. Came to America to visit his mother and ended up falling in love with a girl and with America and staying, became the most patriotic American you'd ever meet, and went on to become the head of security at the Idaho Penitentiary, where he became a legend there as well. He never lost his German accent. He had steel gray hair and steely blue eyes, and you could just tell to look at him for a second. This was not a man to be crossed. He had that command, presence, and air of authority, but toward the end, he became quite sentimental, looking back on the things he had done, and he believed that he would be forgiven, and he wanted two things before he died. He wanted his story, which was the story I ended up writing, and he wanted his bathroom remodeled, and he got them both done and died about a week later.
And you didn't have to do the bathroom remodel, I assume.
No, I didn't have to do that.
Well, you mentioned earlier Dugout Dick, I remember reading about Dugout Dick, and he really didn't die too long ago, April 2010. He was 94.
Right. Right.
But this is a guy who, there's not many of these guys left in America.
No, there aren't. And there used to be quite a few of them in Idaho, River Canyon Hermits.
Mm-hmm.
Dugout Dick, Free Press Francis Wisner, Buckskin Bill, they all had colorful names, and they were equally colorful themselves. Dugout Dick lived over near Salmon in a cave that he had dug into the side of a mountain, ostensibly for mining. And he did do a little mining, and that's why he was allowed to stay there. But over the years, he dug some 20 to 30 caves and rented them out to people for, you know, $1 a night or $15 a month. Entirely self-sufficient, had the strangest diet of anyone I've ever seen, nettles and goat's milk, and part of that was because he had a very touchy stomach. But he lived in his cave on his own terms until age 94. For a short time, he was in a nursing home, and a friend of his had taken there because his health was slipping. And one day he just got up and walked out, hitchhiked back to Salmon, went to his cave, and that's where he died, and died happy. He had also been a railroad tramp and knew all the old railroad hobo songs, which he played on his guitar that had about two strings, sang off key, but they were still somehow beautiful just because they were Dugout Dick. He was a unique Idaho character, and there used to be a lot of them, and now I'm pretty sure they're all gone. I'm told that there is a woman up near Garden Valley who is of the same ilk, but I need to get up and see her even though I'm retired.
Did many people find Dugout Dick? Did people seek him out?
Yes. Johnny Carson wanted him on The Tonight Show. He said no, repeatedly.
Is that right?
He said the show's not there, the show's here. Tourists would stop and visit. One day when I was there was a camera crew from Germany filming him. He became quite famous. There was an article in National Geographic that was partially about him, and after that he was something of a celebrity.
Well, you know, I was mentioning to you before our conversation here that I travel the state to go to state board meetings, and I drive just so I can see Idaho, but I never get off the main drag. And so, for example, I see these signs about the Malad Gorge,
mm-hmm.
and yet have never been there. Help, I'm sure, any number of us who live in Boise and have never gotten out mm-hmm. into the hinterlands. What are we going to see when we go to Malad Gorge?
You've probably driven over it many times and not even known it was there. Mm-hmm. It's on the interstate, Interstate 84, on the way to Twin Falls. And you just flash over, you get a small glimpse of the canyon. And if you're not looking for it, you don't see it at all. But if you take the tunnel exit and turn off and go to the Malad Gorge State Park, you walk out to the edge and it's one step you're on solid ground and the next step you're in thin air falling 300 feet.
Wow.
It's this enormous lava rock canyon with the Malad River, the shortest river in Idaho, I believe, that begins cascading out of rocks to form what they call the Devil's Punch Bowl. It's a seething white mass of white water, and that's where the river begins. And you can stand there on an iron bridge that crosses this and watch the birds sail on the currents and the tumbleweeds blow down the canyon and hear absolutely nothing but the sound of the wind. It's just a spectacular, heart-stopping place. Mm-hmm. And you've gone over it many times. I'd mm-hmm. probably gone over it 1,000 times before I realized it was there. Somebody mm-hmm. told me about it. And I said, oh, mm-hmm. better stop there.
Tim Woodward, thanks so much for joining us at Reader's Corner. And again, the good news for our listeners, you can buy the book, Destination Idaho by Tim Woodward.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Tim Woodward. Next week, National Magazine Award winner Alan Heathcock, author of the short story collection Volt. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.